This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Commercial airlines have just been okayed for direct flights from 10 U.S. cities to Cuba, a historic occurrence in light of the recent warming of relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Today, we'll speak with a woman who was in Cuba more than 50 years ago to document the struggles of the Cuban Revolution. While there, she interviewed many of the major players, including Fidel Castro, his brother and current president Raul Castro, Che Guevara, Celia Sanchez, and many others. The diary she wrote while there took many years to publish. It's called Cuba, A Diary of the Revolution, Inside the Cuban Revolution with Fidel, Raul, Che, and Celia Sanchez. Its author, Dina Stryker, now joins me. She's written a number of other books, including Lunch with Fellini, Dinner with Fidel, A Journey from the Cold War to the Arab Spring. Welcome to the program, Dina.
Thank you so much, Sonali. It's a pleasure.
Thanks so much for joining us. So you were a photojournalist that I understand you were able to take advantage of your non-U.S. citizenship in order to travel to Cuba in 1963. What took you there? What was your assignment when you arrived there, and how long did you spend there?
Well, actually, it was not an assignment. It was my own initiative. I had been working at the news desk of the French news agency in Rome, and I met many people who were coming back or going to Cuba, and the things that they were telling me about the revolution were completely different from what I saw in the press, both the Italian press and the American press. So after my book on the making of the Fellini film 8 and a Half was published, I had a little money in advance, and I was able to travel to Cuba, and I proposed to the French weekly Paris Match to do what they would call a portrait of the person, not a political story. And this magazine, of course, is like kind of like Art Life magazine used to be, with a big emphasis on photographs. And I had been in contact with a French photographer named Pique, who had been to Cuba numerous times, and it was agreed that they would use his photographs, recent photographs of his, with my story if I were able to get it. But I went there completely unaffiliated, unknown, and even though I sent a telegram asking for someone from the foreign ministry to meet me at the plane, nobody showed up. So I was really on my own.
Now, you published this diary many, many years after you first wrote it. Why did it take so long for it to get published?
Well, as I'm sure you know, it was not easy to publish anything that wasn't critical of the Cuban Revolution in the West, whether it was here or in Europe. Actually, because I had been living in Italy at the time I first went to Cuba and I was speaking Italian fluently, I managed for some reason to write this book in Italian. I mean, I had an Italian publisher waiting for it, so I wrote it in Italian, but he cut it so drastically after it was finished that I couldn't agree to having it published in the form he wanted to publish it. And after that, since it was a diary, it was very difficult to find another publisher because it would be old by the time another publisher would gear up to publish it. And after that, of course, things went from bad to worse between Cuba and the West. So it wasn't until now, with the breakthrough in relations, that I was able to find a publisher for the book. And he's done a fantastic job.
So the warming of relations between the U.S. and Cuba has had many repercussions, your book among them. And for our TV audience, I just want to mention that we're showing several of Dina Stryker's photographs. Then you were Dina Boyer, your photographs from Cuba during that time on our screenshots, along with other archival photos of the time. It was, of course, a tumultuous time in Cuba, one of the most exciting places to be in 1963. 3, and you managed to get an interview with Fidel Castro. I understand you had to wait several weeks before he would agree to do the interview. Tell us about that.
Well, it wasn't because he didn't agree to do the interview. It was because the bureaucracy didn't take seriously this woman alone from the West, no affiliation, no assignment, et cetera, totally unknown. And they just sort of didn't put my request through until I finally lost my temper and chewed them out in such a way that they thought, well, maybe we better do something. And once they decided to transmit my request, I was immediately contacted by Fidel's aide de camp and Dr. Rene Vallejo, Comandante Vallejo, who was American trained and spoke English fluently. And he got in touch with me the day before I was due to leave. Actually, no, I'm sorry. It was the foreign ministry that got in touch with me and sent me to the head of the propaganda department of the Communist Party the morning I was supposed to leave. And after a long discussion with this man, he said, listen, if you want, I can assure you that your request will finally be transmitted to Fidel. And if you want to get on the plane, I'll tell them to hold the plane for you. But if you want to stay, be our guest. Of course, I had run out of money by that time, so the only way I could stay was by accepting their hospitality, which, as I'm sure many listeners know, is an absolute no-no for any journalist who values his reputation. You don't take gifts from the people that you're writing about. But I had about 30 seconds to make that decision, and of course I decided to accept the Cuban hospitality. And that's how I finally got through to Fidel. And the next day, I met with him for 3 hours. And then the following day again, and three or four times again in the next 3 weeks, to do this story for Paris Match.
You didn't just speak to Fidel Castro. You spoke to a cohort of people involved in the Cuban Revolution, the top, sort of members of the echelon of people involved in the revolution itself, his brother, Raul Castro. And one of the characters I was so fascinated by was Celia Sanchez, the sort of top-ranked woman, if you will, considered in many ways Fidel's right-hand person. Tell us who Celia Sanchez was. She's just not as well-known as either Raul or Fidel, and certainly not as well-known as Che Guevara.
Right, but she was the power behind the throne in a way that was very positive. Nothing happened without her knowing it, and if she wanted something to happen, it happened. She was by Fidel's side, and she was the person that he absolutely trusted with anything and everything. And she was, in her own right, a really fantastic person. She was the daughter of a provincial doctor, and she joined the revolutionary movement in the early days and worked both in the cities and in the Sierra. And I was fortunate enough to meet her and to have several long conversations with her, because I was really interested in getting to the bottom of the question that was on everybody's mind at that time, which was Fidel lying when he told Herbert Matthews and other American journalists who visited him in the Sierra that he was not a communist? That was the big question still in 1963. Whether he had suddenly become a communist once he took power or suddenly divulged the fact that he was a communist, or whether he had been a communist all along and was plotting behind a facade, saying, no, I'm a Democrat, I want to implement parliamentary elections and the Constitution and all that. So the thrust of when I returned to Cuba after the story appeared in Paris Match with a contract by an Italian publisher, the idea was to query all the people that I could get in touch with that were in the government and ask them to tell me in their own words how they had come to join the movement, what their motivations were, what their background was, and essentially what they understood the goals of the revolution to be. And Celia facilitated many of those interviews. I would say all of them. She would call up the cabinet minister and say, I want you to meet Dina Boyer. And that would happen. The person who held out the longest was Che Guevara, because he really didn't have time to waste, especially with women. It was one of the most interesting conversations that I had, and I must say it was a great challenge, because Che was both very, very intelligent and never forgave anybody for being ignorant of anything.
The cover of your book features some very powerful photos you took of both Che Guevara and Fidel Castro. Would you say that your role as photojournalist was more prominent than as a print journalist in a way? You were keeping a diary, but you were also interviewing these people, but you were also photographing them. How do you define the role that you played in Cuba, or were you making it up as you go along? Because one of the things that jumped out at me from your diary was that this is a story of a young, intrepid journalist who's kind of carving her path as a journalist as she goes along and finds herself in this incredibly historic moment in the world.
Well, I certainly didn't view myself as a photojournalist or a photographer. In fact, my story for Paris Match was accompanied by photographs taken by Peak. I'd always taken photographs ever since I was a child, but I never imagined myself to be a photographer. I had a good camera, I think it was a Canon, and I more or less knew how to use it. I'd say really more or less, because I'd never had instruction in how to take a picture. And it just seemed natural to me that I would document what I was doing as I had documented other things in my life. But in the end, I ended up with an archive of almost 2,000 black and white photographs that was eventually purchased by Duke University, and they were interested enough in it to post it online, where it can still be seen.
Yeah, and we did get some of your photographs from there as well. We'll post a link to that archive from our website later today. Now, you also spent time with a man that very few people who are familiar with Cuba in a cursory way know about, and that is Osvaldo Dorticos. Tell us who he was. I was sort of surprised. I was like, wait, who is this guy? What is his name? Turns out he became president.
Yes. He was asked to become president shortly after the previous president, who I believe was Prio Socarrás Urrutia. I'm not sure at this point because I didn't bone up on my Cuban history for this interview.
It has been, 53 years, right?
Yes, it was a long time ago. But Dorticos was a lawyer, and he had been part of the movement, the Fidel 26th of July movement. And he was the antithesis of most of the other people in the government, because you could have never imagined him with a beard or carrying a rifle or trudging up mountains. He was a very knowledgeable, very soft-spoken man, a man with definite authority, but not the kind of flamboyant authority that some of the other people in the government had. And I had a very interesting and informative conversation with him precisely about the goals of the revolution and how it had evolved from one period to another. He was a key person that I interviewed. And I remember that he had an office in the presidential palace, and he told me that the office had previously been occupied by Fidel, but that Fidel never went there. So finally they decided, well, it's better for Dorticos to have it, because he's going to be in the office all day long. And it was a nice office, so they gave it. It became Dorticos' office, and Fidel never had an office anywhere, at least as far as I knew.
I'm speaking with Dina Stryker. She is the author of Cuba, A Diary of the Revolution, Inside the Cuban Revolution, with Fidel, Raul, Che, and Celia Sanchez. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're going to keep Dina on for an extended conversation that you can find in the on-demand premium content of our website. Dina, in your book, you refer to as your meetings with the 12, capitalized the 12. Tell us who the 12 were.
Okay, the 12 referred to what at a precise moment in time was Fidel counting heads after they landed on the Cuban coast coming from Mexico. Rather disastrous landing. They were discovered almost immediately in some kind of swampy situation. Many of them were killed. At one point in that terrible day, Fidel turned around and counted heads and said, "Oh my God, we were 82 and now we're 12. Actually, it was never clear whether they were 11 or 13 or 12, but that's the way they told me this story. So this group of people was still part of the government. They were the ministers in 1963, these people who had landed in 1959 with Fidel. And that those were the ones that I referred to them as a group, as the 12, and I went methodically interviewing one after the other.
Of all the interviews you did, which one stands out the most? You mentioned the interview with Che Guevara was fascinating. Was that the most interesting?
It was definitely the most challenging. My interview with Raul was also very interesting. The first time I met Raul, he came impromptu to my hotel to set up an appointment for me to interview him. That was how he put it. And he sort of blew in and had a notebook in his hand, which was his diary, where he was going to, you know, write down what time we were going to meet and where we were going to meet. And we had a very brief conversation. I think we remained standing in the middle of the room. And as he was about to leave, he saw a book that I had been reading on the sofa, and he picked it up, and it was Engels' Origins of the Family and Private Property in Italian. And he looked at it, and he said, "Well, haha, make sure the same thing doesn't happen to you that happened to me," after reading that. I said, "What was that?" He said, "You become a communist."
So some real insight into these characters. Dina, looking today at what has happened in Cuba, first of all, you know, Fidel still living, Raul still living and replacing his brother as president, Che prematurely, with a horrible CIA-linked death. Could you have predicted that this history would have played out the way it did? I mean, it took more than 50 years from the time you were in Cuba to where the U.S. government could even just send a president to meet with leaders of the revolution. Just a remarkable, but in many ways, a tragic history.
Well, it's tragic when you think of all the people that died, all the people that were deprived of vital medicines or other life-saving, you know, things that they couldn't have because of their blockade. But it's also a very inspiring history. And certainly 50 years ago, I don't think anybody knew or could have even guessed or predicted that this situation, this standoff, would last so long. But I will tell you that at one point when I was discussing this with Fidel early on in one of our very first conversations, he said, "You know what? I wouldn't mind if we stayed 50 years without any American tourists here with their loud voices and their crazy shirts." It was the period when men were wearing these really garish shirts. I don't know if anybody remembers that, but I do. And I think it's really amazing that he lived to see exactly that, which is happening now. Although I think that the American tourists who are going to Cuba are very different from the ones that were there 50 years ago, who were going on a lark, who were just going for the nightclubs and the pretty girls often and so on. And, you know, they were expecting different things and going for different things from what the American tourists in Cuba are going for now.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Dina, for joining us today and for seeing your work being vindicated and after so many years actually published in English in the United States. Congratulations to you on the publication of the book and good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
Dina Stryker is a photojournalist, and we've been talking about her book, Cuba, Diary of the Revolution, Inside the Cuban Revolution, with Fidel, Raul, Che, and Celia Sanchez. She's written a number of other books, including Lunch with Fellini, Dinner with Fidel, A Journey from the Cold War to the Arab Spring. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.